A key principle that I think a lot of people lack is understanding what an AI agent is. It all comes down to one word, agency. When you talk about an AI agent, you're talking about giving an LLM agency to make decisions, guide its own way, solve problems, and achieve goals. So how is that different? Normally, when you're talking to ChatGPT or another interface like Claude, your interactions are just, I'm asking a question, it comes back with a response. In no way are you giving the LLM agency.
Welcome to ODSE's AIX podcast, your gateway to the latest in AI and data science. Whether you're an aspiring data scientist or a seasoned AI professional, we bring you insights from the best minds in the field, shaping the future of AI. This episode is sponsored by ODSE West, the premier AI Builders Conference, celebrating its 10th year this October 28th to 30th in San Francisco and virtually. Learn more at odsc.com/California and use the code PODCAST for an exclusive 10% discount. We are also holding another virtual three-week conference, the Agentic AI Summit, this July 15th to 30th. Learn more at summit.ai. Seamus McGovern, the founder of ODSE, will be your host today.
In this episode, we sit down with Michael Lanham, author of the book AI Agents in Action, for a practical and forward-looking conversation about building intelligent, goal-driven AI agents. Drawing from his cross-industry experience in game development, fintech, and agtech, Michael explains how we're moving beyond prompt-response chatbots towards agents that reason, act, and collaborate. Topics we'll cover in this conversation include the difference between agents, chatbots, and traditional automation, the importance of prompt engineering, an explanation of MCP, Message Control Protocol, and its role in enabling tool use and multi-agent coordination, the power of agentic memory systems, evaluation strategies for AI agent workflows, agentic AI frameworks like AutoGen, CrewAI, and OpenAI Agent SDK, and the future of agents as collaborative partners, not just tools. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
To help our audience get to know you, Michael, can you give us a brief overview of your career?
I really started off in game programming back in the 90s, worked with academics shortly after, developing a game for them. It actually started my journey into deep learning, genetic algorithms, and machine learning, building a game and using neural networks to do decision paths and stuff like that. From there, I went to a small consulting oil and gas company, heavily academic focused, where we worked on building engineering applications. So there's a lot of machine learning and data science in that area. I had 80 people in my team, R&D, for everything from doing a lot of machine learning to just engineering applications and stuff like that. This is about 2009, 2010, and I was actually trying to start an AI group or a deep learning group at that time. And nobody really wanted to jump into it. They had been burned so many times before by the journey of the AI. I can remember things didn't really start to turn around at about 2012 when Hinton sort of did his functional neural networks. And that was the first big moment. It sort of cascaded a whole bunch of changes. And then since everybody was concerned for a number of years that we're going to go back into a AI winter, if you will, and that never happened again. And it certainly, I don't think it's going to happen anytime in the future. Working through a lot of different companies, primarily as a machine learning AI, working on everything from the cannabis industry, doing business intelligence to regulations, oil and gas industry, working on horizontal drilling, using generative AI to predict the subsurface and using deep reinforcement learning to guide oil drilling. Now I work in ag tech and we build an agentic system. It helps people support and service agricultural equipment.
A fascinating range of industries you worked in, cannabis industry to oil and gas to agricultural, ag tech, very hot area for AI right now. Who better to tell us about agentic AI? People view agents and agentic AI as this brand new thing. Those of us who worked in computer science know agents and this concept of agentic workflow has been around for decades in computer science. And now with AI, it's boosting it, so to speak. But before we get into that, because I want to bring our listeners on a journey from understanding the basic concepts of agents to some more advanced concepts. So I think for our listeners who are new to AI agents, it's important to understand what an AI agent actually is. We're here to talk about a book you published on agents. You do a great job in that book defining what an agent is. So if you can talk a little bit about who the audience for the book is and tell us your definition of an agent.
Yeah, so I started writing the book way back in 2023. I had been working at Samend, a fintech startup, and traditional LLM processes for categorization of messaging and stuff like that. But then we decided to use LLMs. And from LLMs, we decided to use agents. And I built, based on AutoGPT and some of these earlier examples, some agent systems. And it really hit me the power of agents and using this ability to do things with agents. a key principle that I think a lot of people lack is understanding what an agent is or what an AI agent is. It all comes down to one word, agency. When you talk about an AI agent, you're talking about giving an LLM agency to make decisions, guide its own way, solve problems, and achieve goals. So how is that different? Normally, when you're talking to ChatGPT or another interface like Claude, your interactions are just, I'm asking a question, it comes back with a response. That in no way are you giving the LLM agency. We do see a lot more of that coming now using tools like deep research, giving a whole bunch of stuff that you want to have happen. You ask the deep research tool to give me an answer on this. It goes away for 15 minutes. Often that 15 minutes, it has agency to make these decisions. It knows where to search, where it can pull information from, where it collects all this information, and then being able to summarize all the information. That's sort of the big piece I think a lot of people have to overcome, understanding the difference between a prompt and talking directly with an LLM and being able to engage with an LLM that is an agent and has agency in making decisions, using tools, and doing a bunch of other things that it needs to do.
Yeah, Michael, I think that's so spot on. And we can actually later on this conversation talk about AI and give an AI agency as well, because I think it's such an important part of the discussion and the dialogue right now. But to keep it grounded, because I want people to look at your book, because it was one of the first books that really gave me a holistic view of how agents work, what's possible with them. Very hands-on, very practical, lots of examples. Can you walk us through what an AI agent is in terms of how it's different from traditional software, chatbots, and even automation tools like robotic process automation, RPA?
Okay. So there's two components to an agent, right? It's giving them agency, but allowing them to reason and plan, if you will. A lot of the earlier models, you would have to enter in the prompt how the agent should plan, how it should think through its steps. So you see a lot of these things, giving the LLM time to think and decide and then execute tasks, get the responses, be able to look at these types of things and determine the outcome and chain these things together. If you were looking at 4, this is even before 4.0, which is more of a reasoning model, 4 wouldn't handle this very well. It wouldn't do that loop. It wouldn't be able to have the autonomy or the agency to make a number of decisions internally. The great thing now with the models we have some effective reasoning is the ability to, if you give it a task to plan me a trip, it can go on and use the tool to search a website to find a bunch of trips. It can find information about you. Maybe it has in its memory that it can then look up and say, this is their preferences. This is what they like. I'm going to choose these ones. And I'm going to look at maybe then planning different events and things in the itinerary. And then coming back and then giving all this information back to the user. There's a key difference between a particular prompt, which you call a prompt or a system prompt, where you're just telling an LLM to give me a response about something, but generally it's just going to execute it once and then come back. With agency, you're giving the LLM either one or multiple tools that it can decide on when to use and how to use them. And it's also combining those tools together to build or append to some sort of output and generate some combined output. A big thing that I think turns a light bulb is you really have to write a fairly, well, sometimes not so simple of a prompt. The prompt engineering is a key aspect of this because you want to define how the agent should think through its steps and what its workflow should be. So in that prompt, you're defining how the agent uses its agency to define and answer its solutions. You can be a little more loose and say, you're just an agent with this persona and answer these questions, and then it decides, and then quite well. The more guidance in that workflow, the better your agent's going to perform.
Yeah, I love that description, Michael, because you touched upon so many different aspects there, tools, reasoning, planning. You also touched upon this whole idea of prompt engineering. I really believe prompt engineering is making AI very accessible right now, because think about what you said at the very start, how people interact with AI right now. It might be Anthropic, Claude, Perplexity, OpenAI, various flavors of models, and they give it a question. They don't give it agency. They wait for a response. The whole decision-making and agency is definitely one question I want to get into, but just focusing on prompt engineering for a second, because I think that's a key skill to master to understand how to build agentic workflows.
Yeah, I'm a big proponent of prompt engineering. Unfortunately, I think prompt engineering has got a bit of a bad name because it's often seen as, you know, as this whole turn was coming about, you'd hear people getting salaries of $300,000 for being prompt engineers, and people like, well, that's just stupid. But prompt engineering is very important to everything I construct and use. And a lot of times people think of prompt engineering as some sort of mystic way that you need to talk to an LLM. It's not that. There's a number of basic rules you need to follow and get good at. A big one is defining structure in your prompt the same way you'd want somebody else to read it. You want to be able to make it accessible for the LM to be able to understand the information. Delimiters is another key aspect. So if you can delimit sections and you can mark things bold and stuff like that's going to help the LM as much as possible. And another key thing is, you know, maybe injecting some of those reasoning things like think step by step or use this pattern of React where you're, you know, reasoning and acting. Those can also help, but there's other key terms that different LMs respond to better than others. So it's getting comfortable with what you're injecting into the LM to guide it with the things it needs to do. But it's a key principle for anything that we build. And some of the prompts we build, they're just huge.
We find that prompting skill is a key skill that's kind of overlooked from AI experts, the engineers, because it's not writing code, it's writing prompts. We find it has a massive impact on an agent's performance.
Absolutely.
Yeah, as you mentioned, a pretty common agentic framework, React there, reason, and then action. And then those decision-making processes can be, I know it's debatable over what kind of model you're using. You might be using a hybrid model from Claude, which can do system one and system two. Chain of thought prompting is very important. I do some training in this myself. So I think I'll include in the show notes a list of prompt engineering techniques. My first one for beginners is always use the LLM to help you create the prompt. And then for prompt engineering, is there a favorite techniques you have? I mentioned chain of thought. The reasoning models are supposed to have chain of thought built in. When I'm trying to make a decision with various different outcomes and scenarios, tree of thought is one of my favorite ones. So any advice you can give people for different reasoning prompts?
In the first edition of AI Agents in Action, a lot of the reasoning was what was popular at the time. So it was chain of thought, the think step-by-step thing that you can add. What I've added in the second edition is the React framework. Because MCP, Model Context Protocol, which we haven't really gone into that much yet, it's so accessible, there's a sequential thinking server, which is kind of like a scratch pad for reasoning. So it allows the LM or the agent sort of use this MCP server, sequential thinking, that allows it to think through problems. And you can set it up to do tree of thought, chain of thought. You can set it up to do React. And I have a whole chapter in my upcoming book, the second edition of AI Agents in Action, where it talks about using these reasoning planning strategies. Another key thing is when you're using things like step-by-step and chain of thought, you have to let the agent or the LM output the chain of thought steps, right? If you're not allowing it to do it, you're not really enlisting that behavior. So by coupling this with sequential thinking, which allows it to write these things to a server in a loose form of memory, it allows a way of ejecting these thoughts that it then can use later and think about and understand, and then it gets better at reasoning and ultimately planning and solving goals.
Yeah, MCP is a very hot topic, and maybe we can delve into that a little bit. I'm sure a lot of our listeners are familiar with MCP, Message Control Protocol. It came out from Anthropic, published a blog on it. It was last November. I'll include a link to that in the show notes. It's mentioned in some of our previous podcasts, but it really seemed to take off around February or March. Everyone started talking about it, especially here in New England. All these agents spring up like weeds in spring. So talk a little bit more about MCP, that Message Control Protocol, and its structure around role, content, and context. Google's also making a big push for their A2A or agent to agent. So I know a lot of frameworks like LangChain, AutoGen, and AgentOps have adopted MCP, and MCP servers are proliferating left and right.
Yeah, MCP is really, it's probably one of the technologies I think it's blown up massively. The amount of stuff that's come out of this from MCP is incredible. A lot of it's plugged into Visual Studio Code. They have ways of integrating MCP and even Claude. So Claude Desktop, all you typically have a couple of MCP tools or servers that connect to PowerPoint, connect to our ticketing system, connect to a bunch of things, right? Engage with Claude to say, here, I want to do this. The ability to do quick integrations with all these MCP servers becomes really powerful. And adds a whole level of capability to agents now, because you can easily drop in a bunch of these MCP servers. I go into a lot of detail on OpenAI Agents SDK, which is currently my favorite for building agents, because it's simple enough to do a number of things, but it's sophisticated enough that you can get in and do a couple of specialized things if you need to. And it handles a bunch of these patterns really well, and it handles the MCP really well. So you can just quickly, in about 10 lines of code, fire up an agent, give it some instructions, and attach an MCP server to it, and it's off doing its thing, right? So it's pretty powerful stuff, and being able to connect all these MCP servers are great. But there becomes a limit where you have to cut these things up and make now agent workflows or flows, which I also get into the second edition of the book. But in comparison to agent from Google, that is more of a platform where you're wanting to actually directly connect with agent to agent.
Yeah.
It essentially uses that pattern that OpenAI established way back when they released ChatGPT with this ability to use tools. They didn't really take it very far, though. A big part of that is because the models really weren't up to using a lot of tools altogether and being able to have this agency and decision-making and this reasoning to use a bunch of tools in succession. Now you can simply plug in an MCP server into Claude and you ask it to interact with it, and it takes this agency and it's going off and using 6 or 7 tools within an MCP server to do a whole bunch of stuff for you. A good use case I often show to people is here. I'm going to enter a paragraph about how I want to create this PowerPoint presentation. I have a PowerPoint MCP hooked up to Claude, and off it goes and creates me a PowerPoint presentation. 10 or 15 slides in no time at all. Lots of capability, lots of power there. And I think as we add more MCP servers, that'll be great. But I caution people, you don't want to add too many tools to an agent because it just becomes a lot of overhead. It confuses the agent, the LLM, or whatever you have. You want to sort of limit that. So you have to be careful in what you do. If you're using a whole bunch of these tools, it's often time to look at multi-agent workflows.
That's great insight, Michael. MCP uses exploded. And you hit upon the key concept. Last year, when we were trying to build these agentic workflows, we ended up chaining tons of tools together because multi-agent systems were a little brittle and still are to a certain degree. And I think that's one of the key concepts there, because it adds that structure and defines at a standardized level how a tool should be invoked, making sure you provide the correct inputs and outputs and making it easier to chain those tools together. And you're right, we get the opposite problem because now it's super easy to chain all those tools together. It can carry metadata, track which tools are being called, and it can also do reasoning. I think React and a few other reason patterns they provide apart from React as well. That's pretty cool. One of my favorite uses of it as well is we'll talk about evaluations, but evaluating agentic workflow is so hard. And we found it's made it easier to debug agentic workflows. And then, of course, observing what's actually going on, because that's been a bit of a black box.
Evaluation is a huge thing, especially for what I'm doing right now, building agentic workflows for agricultural equipment support. These are million-dollar pieces of equipment. We have to make sure the agents are giving them good answers and they're really well-grounded in the answers they're giving, right? So you want to adhere to a lot of the source material, the manuals, and all that stuff. We've looked at a lot of different patterns, from just, you know, grounding patterns that look at how the agents are responding to a whole bunch of other stuff. What we ultimately did was build agents that evaluate the agents solving the workflow. They can assist us in saying, yes, they're doing the right thing at this stage or not. Guardrails are becoming a big thing. OpenAI Agents SDK, for instance, introduces guardrails. One of the examples I have in my second edition of my book is using agents within a guardrail to make sure that the LLM is responding correctly, making sure that the answer is grounded in source material. So that's a key aspect. I definitely recommend anybody building an agentic system, set up evaluation or think strongly about evaluating what your agent's supposed to be doing and constantly checking that, constantly baselining what your agent's doing and how it's performing. It gives you the ability to change your prompts, altering your system configuration, changing your agents, all that stuff. Evaluation is a really key metric there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do, because we spent a lot of time last year, the last couple of years, talking about LLM evaluations and how to evaluate LLMs, open source ones, closed source ones. Lots of open source platforms out there. I'll link a few to the show notes. One of my favorite is Outlines or .txt. I recall when I was reading your book late February, early March, you used the phrase grounding evaluation related to an LLM, because an LLM really is the engine of an agent, because you want to make sure the outputs, they're anchored to verifiable information. So with LLMs, we're doing that with RAG and stuff like that. But then looking at responses, making sure the output was correct, that output was often input to the next chain or tool or something like that. And then one of the things I've struggled with is calling these various tools. Now you're not just trying to evaluate the response from the LLM, but also the response from that tool itself. Yeah, if you can talk to that ball of evaluation wax, so to speak.
For everything we do in any sort of setup, we use OTEL tracing. So open telemetry tracing, if you will, so we can monitor all activity, make sure that the agents are doing everything we need. There's a great tool out recently called Rise Phoenix. And it allows you to log all this stuff. The other thing I really like about OpenAI Agents SDK is it out of the box allows you to capture all these OTEL tracing and look at what the agents are doing. But if you're using other tools, you want to be a little more sophisticated and you want to sort of break things into projects, Arise Phoenix is an excellent tool. It shows you every step, what the model is, what the input is, what the prompt is, what the output was. And then you can capture those sessions within their tool. You can actually use the prompt and everything that went into the prompt and test the output. So you can test the variability of your output. LLMs are a little bit variable sometimes. They're going to give you different answers. You want to make sure that you're within constraints there. You can test variations in models. You can test variations in your prompts. You can do additional prompt engineering to modify your prompts, maybe add more rules or trim down your prompts. It's a very powerful tool. One that I highly recommend is Arize Phoenix. AI Agents SDK also has much of this built in where it automatically captures all this, go to the OpenAI dashboard, and you can see these API things. A key aspect is being able to see what the agent's doing, how they're interacting with the prompts, and how they're passing messages on. For anybody building things like this, you want to be able to track that information and inject evaluation steps or guardrails measuring the success or how well things are going. It doesn't necessarily have to be real time, but something you can capture. Take snapshots and look at Phoenix is a great tool for that because it allows you to capture, annotate the prompt and stuff like that within their tool. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. We've actually done a whole podcast on Phoenix from Arize AI. Great awesome. Project. Who else does a good job? Because I'm wondering if there's a list of MPC servers we can provide to our users.
There's a bunch of libraries or collections. Smithery is a big one. Smithery is becoming quite popular. It hosts a number of servers. If you wanted to use an MPX install, you put in Smithery, add your key, and it'll allow you to pull down the server. But again, it's an open collection, so you have to be careful on which MCP servers you're using. I think that's also a big thing we have to warn people about is don't pull down anything. You want to make sure that you understand what's going on.
How would you advise doing that? Evaluation is key there. Do you want to avoid a prompt injection, an agent prompt injection, and things like that, right?
And not to mention whatever the MCP server is doing, right? Whatever tools it's using, the APIs it's calling. So I would always look for how many stars or how many downloads it's got. Maybe do a deep research on the tool itself. There's a lot of good ones, though. There's a lot of good reference ones like Slack and a whole bunch of these other several database ones. Microsoft have been kind of slow to the game, but now they're producing a number of cool MCP tools. But, you know, everything from integrating with Office to a whole bunch of other stuff. Anthropic is just releasing a new thing with applications and tools that they're looking at. And I'm not sure if that's consequence of that is actually going to be using that to build MCP tools. I think that's probably the next phase, but right now it's sort of like here, build games and stuff like that.
Yeah, Smithery.ai is a great resource. It's got over 7,000 extensions. And as you said, most are built by the community. And if you have a tool, like we use Notion, databases, Superbase, Perplexity, any tool you can think of, there is probably an MCP server out there for that. Because the protocol itself is so simple that pretty much everyone adapted it fairly quickly. And some of these have got thousands, tens of thousands of downloads. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah. It just shows the power and quick adoption that people are embracing MCP. When I started using Siri, it was about 1,000 and now it's over 7,000. It's growing so fast.
Yeah. And so for our listeners, regardless of their beginners or just starting to understand AI, or even for those of us who are advanced practitioners, an interesting thing about the challenges of agents, because we touched upon reasoning. We haven't really talked about memory. Would love to talk about memory more, because one of the key things when you have different kinds of memory in an agent, now you have reasoning, and then you bring in these feedback loops about these various components within an agent, because we want to get to multi-agents, but I just want to talk about the components within an agent. So if we can discuss the different types of memory, something I've spent a lot of time working on. You go to people and there's many different definitions of memory, and I have a few of my own favorites, but we can talk about agentic memory, which I think is really very important for people to understand. Michael, that'd be great.
So memory and knowledge fall under the retrieval augmented generation workflow. A lot of RAG applications and memory applications are all semantic. So you're taking a piece of text, you're embedding it down to a vector and using vector similarity matching, similar things you wanted to find. In memory, there can be different types of memory where you're looking at episodic, procedural, and these could be variations of how you're taking the information and storing it, either semantically, or another option is you don't necessarily have to just force yourself to using semantic search. You can use database search, keyword search, graph systems. Graph systems are becoming quite popular. As long as you set up the tools and the agent knows how to interact with these systems, MCP is a great tool or a great interface for a lot of these things, then you give them the ability to use these tools. And then for memory, you have the agent using the memory. But a big thing about memory systems is you want to make sure that the type of memory you're using, you use some of the same doctrines or things like forgetting. Forgetting is a big aspect that we often forget about, right? So you don't always want to have all the memories treated the same. You want more of the recent memories to be treated more importantly than older memories. That means sometimes you're forgetting some of those older memories. So to build into your system, when you're doing a whole bunch of these, I'm going to save a bunch of these conversations about the user had that you often want to maybe dump a bunch of the earlier conversations or the earlier things that you have. Another good thing about this aspect is also compression. It's like remember certain key details about events 2 years ago, but you didn't necessarily recommend all the exact details. Compression works by taking a whole bunch of these memories, compressing them down to the important details as a summarization, and then that's the memory that you can refer to. It's a way of minimizing the amount of memory that the agent has to search through and making things more relevant. Relevant is a key aspect for knowledge and memory. When you're asking the agent to find things based on what it needs to search for, either memory or knowledge, you want to know or understand that the items you're getting back are very relevant to the things it's asking, right? So if you're asking for what movie should I watch, you want to make sure that the memories or the knowledge coming back are related to movies. You don't want other things in there like your favorite dinner. That's where semantic search comes in, a whole bunch of other ways that you can break that down. If you're looking at factual memory, you would use a database and the agent would pull this stuff back. That works well for episodic. You want to remember events or procedures, like procedural steps, and you want to make sure that you remember the exact steps. You would often enter them into either a graph database or a database, a relational database. Semantic doesn't work so well because it might return similar steps, documents, memories, or knowledge. So that's why you have to understand how the relevance relates to what's getting returned and how the types of memory or knowledge that you're storing are relevant to the storage mechanism. If events or episodic memory, you'd want to use databases and stuff like that, or procedural memory similar. If you're just looking for raw conversational memory or things like that, then semantic memory would make sense. Different types of memory to different types of storage mechanism to different ways of returning your best way of getting relevance for your the memories and knowledge you want to return.
Yeah, that's a very good point about people sometimes, because everyone's focusing on that storing everything. I did have this conversation with someone the other day about, do we need to remember everything, or how do we attach importance to memory? Back when I was doing pricing models for equities and stuff like that, we're very much focused on geometric Brownian motion, which kind of treats the price of a stock as a Markov process. When you're looking at the price path, the best price to start with is just the very last one. So in that way, there are models you can use for assigning importance to certain data points. That's something I haven't thought too much about, which I think is quite interesting. And then interesting what you said about procedural and episodic memory. People can be a little bit dogmatic, like short-term memories, like it's the context window if you're working with LLMs. But anyway, that's different. If you're in an agentic AI, you need some kind of a store, like a vector store, or Chroma, or Weaviate. So Michael, now that we understand a little more about how agents work and some of the challenges and evaluations, as you mentioned, AI agency is a very powerful concept. It's really about giving agents decision ownerships, which again is something that a lot of people are thinking hard about. You work with a lot of enterprises. They're still working on governance and how to trust AI. I remember in your book, you talked about giving an agent a goal space. I want to talk about this shift from automation to collaboration. When you start to give these agents a goal, that's quite a different task. Now with MCP and so many servers out there, it's no longer can it do a task, but how can an agent decide how to do a task in that goal space you talked about in your book? And also, I know you've got a gaming background, so I'm sure at some point you probably looked at reinforcement learning as well, if you can touch upon those subjects.
A big thing that I think a lot of people lose focus of when you're implementing agents is you kind of have two paths, right? There's I want to build agents that can collaborate to answer my question, or I have a pretty good idea what the answer to the question should be, or at least the guidelines around that question. I just want to build an agent that can automate that task. A good example of this is a deep research agent that goes off, gets a bunch of information from the internet, or whatever its data sources are, returning that and spitting out the answer. That's a well-described workflow that it's easy to automate. And every company has a whole bunch of these different workflows that they can automate. A big one is create a PowerPoint presentation, like having agents to build your PowerPoint presentation, include the graphics and maybe videos and stuff like that. That's all powerful. Collaboration workflows or agents are when you're kind of not sure what the answer is. At least this is where I typically use collaboration agents. CrewAI and LangChain or AutoGen are good examples of collaboration platforms. And I've used both of those platforms to help me overcome challenges when I didn't really know how to get to an answer. I knew what the starting point was and I knew what the ending point was. It was in a code example. I knew that I had this code or this document and I know I had to get to this version of this document somehow. And I just gave that to AutoGen and I said, here's what the beginning document should be, and here's what the ending document should be. It gave it a couple agents, and it cycled through, and it solved it. It wasn't necessarily efficient. There's ways of tracking how many times an agent comes up and thinks about the same thing, gets into these same questions. But the power of it sort of thinks outside of the box, and it iterates and does this workflow that you might do if you're whiteboarding the thing for a couple hours with work colleagues. It's very good at solving these things and then spinning out the answer. I find it works really well if you can give it a starting point and an ending point. Oftentimes, you may just say, see what happens. I see that as a really good place for these types of agent systems where you talk about these interviews with Sam Altman where he's going, they're going to start researching these things and start thinking outside the box. Those are really those collaboration agent systems that are going to be start doing that, right? It's not those type of agent systems that we often build, in my case, answer support service questions, for instance, or others automating agent tasks. These collaboration agents have some really good potential on discovering new technologies and new ways of doing things. I often use them for that purpose. I wrote a book called Learn Python Game Development with ChatGPT, which was essentially, how do you vibe code to learn how to game program? This is nice. Before vibe coding. This is before vibe coding was a thing. One aspect was that I was using GPT 3.5 or 4 back then. I wanted to use it Python to build a 3D game environment, for instance. And it was really difficult. It was always breaking. It gave the same problem to Autogen, one of these collaboration frameworks. And sure enough, over time, it spit out a working 3D game. And this was a really early model, and it did a really good job. And that's where these powers and capabilities come from. It employs concepts of memory, understanding what's happening, and making changes and feedback, and it's a self-evaluating. But it's not something I would rely on to put into production.
Yeah, I got to confess that I wanted to be a game developer, and I thought my math was pretty good. And I was trying to build these gaming engines, coding. I gave up after 3 or 4 months. Compared to gaming development, data science was a walk in the park. I'm going to try that in my copious spare time. I love that description of collaboration agents, because another powerful concept in your book is this idea of multi-agent systems where multiple agents collaborate to solve problems, right? As the book progresses, you delve into multi-agent systems using tools like Autogen and CrewAI. Can you talk about some of the main advantages of multi-agent systems over single-agent ones? Because the tendency is, especially now with MCP out, let me just chain a ton of tools together, especially in these collaborative or complex task settings.
Yeah, so separate a use case, right? So you have the collaboration workflows where you're looking at solving or coming up with something. And that's where collaboration agents, I think, really shine. And then there's agent systems where you have an agent using 50 tools to do some task and it's not performing well. That's where you would take that agent and break it up into flow of agents. So one agent would do something and then pass it off to the next agent. Or there's another sort of popular pattern is the orchestration hub spoke pattern that you see often where you have one agent that's central and has a bunch of workers that can do various tasks like search the web. Each of these sub agents are connected to a bunch of MCP tools that are executing these things and spitting the information back to the orchestrator agent that then collects everything and sends it back. I like flow agents as well, where you have one agent that does something and hands off that task to the next agent and so on. But those are fairly easy to build because you can think of it as if you're in an office and you've got somebody doing one piece of work, or an assembly line, and you have one person doing one piece of work and the next person does the next piece of work and so on. If it's a collaboration side where you use a number of different agents, and there's the more structured workflow side where you actually want to solve problems, automate tasks. On the collaboration side, you have different patterns that you can use within the collaboration side. A common one is you have a team of agents that you give each of the agents a separate role. So one would be the architect, one of the software developer, one of the QA person, one of the product person, et cetera. They all work together and collaborate based on their individual roles and what they need to do and how they need to spit out an answer. That's very effective on building things, but sometimes you have to be very specific in what you want to build. So if you're less specific, you're going to get some variation to your output. That isn't good for production systems, but it builds something cool and powerful. I've used this pattern multiple times to solve problems that I couldn't get an LLM to help me solve. I've thrown it at a group of agents and they were able to solve this problem. Back in the days when Stack Overflow was a thing, that was where you would often go for this knowledge. I think a lot of people are reverting to LLMs, which is good and bad because there goes Stack Overflow and this base of knowledge. I've come into a couple of problems recently where I either sort of asked an individual agent to solve it, like being able to Dockerize a container or something like that, some really technical thing that I'm less knowledgeable about, asking a group of agents to solve that problem, looking at their respective duties and what they're doing to be able to solve the issue. It becomes really powerful because not only is it just sort of simple problems, and it works through these things, right? You can give it to, solve the task of installing the software. I can't seem to get it to work. And it works through iterations and different variations. With a team of agents, one agent might say, well, no, you got to do this because of this and stuff like that. And they eventually work out a solution. Does it cost $10? Maybe, but you do come up with a solution, and it's kind of cool how it comes with these solutions. And the power of that collaboration is going to become a lot more popular for people just asking questions and seeing what the answer comes out, right? A good example is, you know, we got into the discussion of VO3 and the movies and video generation. What's to say that you couldn't give the collaboration team of agents, director, editor, and all these things, giving them the build me a movie that does this, and here's these tools, and they go off and build a movie. I think that would be really cool.
No, I love that, Michael, because we were chatting briefly before we started recording, and I was mentioning that I've been astounded by the rapid progress we've seen in the creative fields, because I know you've a background in AI filmmaking. And Sora came out last year to huge fanfare, but I was pretty blown away with Google's VO3. Hadn't really played around much with VO2 or the early versions, but VO3, I managed to get my hands on some credits. And whereas Sora is great for creating videos, VO3, it felt more like filmmaking because I was able to give it text to video. So for our audience who have not used it, it's text to video prompt. It allows you to put in audio into the video and do better storyboarding, better scripting. It was pretty incredible to see that. Where do you see all this going as an AI filmmaker?
I think, actually, there was Zachary Levi. There's a good interview of him on YouTube that I just covered recently, and I strongly agree with him. A lot of people are saying, you know, movies, all this stuff is really there because of art's sake. And you look at the movie industry these days and the movies that a lot of people go to, there's not really a lot of actors going on. A major part of the movie is special effects and CGI. And I think a big part of that, the ability to transform old action stars or any stars of anywhere, you license their content. I think the example he uses in the interview is Gene Kelly. Gene Kelly is now in the movie Transformers, or a movie like Transformers that you build or stuff like that because you wanted to see Gene Kelly.
Yeah.
Or some other star from way past that you would never expect. There's a lot of power there, or even given the ability to introduce your own self into this content.
That's an interesting concept.
That ability to inject yourself into that content is going to become a huge aspect, yeah. I think will really disrupt the market.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be interesting how this evolves. But getting back, I think we've covered the technical aspects really well. And as a practitioner, I really want to talk a little bit about where we see this all going. A lot of people complain the field is moving so fast. So sometimes it pays to think ahead a little bit. One last technical aspect I want to touch upon, because people get very excited about agentic AI. And by the way, we've got an Agentic AI Summit, a virtual one coming up in July. It's run over 3 weeks. There's lots of free sessions there, by the way, and there's also training. One of the aspects we struggle with is the cost of these agentic workflows, right? So the token usage goes way up. And then the latency becomes a real problem. How do you balance cost, performance, scalability, especially around these multi-agent systems we just did in production?
Yeah, it's a big part of building working token-consuming agent workflows that are consuming hundreds of thousands of tokens just for one workflow. A big part of it is breaking out the pieces the agents don't need to do and making them software, essentially. The powerful aspect of using agents is they can integrate easily with systems. They can connect with virtually any system, understand it quickly, and take the information from it. Very powerful. It allows us not to have to hard code interfaces. It allows us not to worry about APIs, all this stuff. That's all become extracted away. But there becomes a point in your workflow where you're always doing the same step. For instance, a workflow where you're always pulling documents. Does it really make sense to give the agent a tool to do that and then give the content to the agent, right? Instead of empowering the agent with a tool and then just giving the agent the agency to go through those documents, decide which one is relevant and returning, right? So there's a practicality of these systems and being able to overcome that. But then the latency being tied to a foundational model is probably a big aspect of things. We often talk about how can we get away from having to subscribe to this foundational model? How can we reduce that? One of the key things we try to do is practicalize parts of the workflow where we turn them to software, that part of the software does it, where we still need to use agencies and the power of AI to overcome things, because just managing that challenge would be really difficult. That doesn't mean we couldn't use agents to build the software that makes those things practical. So we actually get into a loop where we can have an agent system that could self-improve itself by practicalized parts of the workflow that don't necessarily need to be agents anymore.
Absolutely. You mentioned earlier Phoenix, it's an open source project from Arize, but we've had DevOps, MLOps, and now AgentOps. So I think there's some good open source tools out there for looking at this as well. LangFuse is one I've been looking at lately, so I'll include that in the show notes. But I just want to get back to multi-agent systems because I am quite fascinated about what the future holds for multi-agent systems. You've written extensively about multi-agent systems. I'm sure that's going to be a big part of the second version of the book as well. At what point do you think AI agents are ready to act as digital teammates rather than task as executors? Capabilities need to evolve there. One of the things I've been thinking a lot about is as we build our agentic workflow, the next variation we want is shift from this agentic workflow as a tool mindset and start viewing AI as something that can reason, reflect, react, take initiative. We mentioned the React framework there and other ones as well. So really, what's it going to take for organizations and people to be comfortable fully embracing agents as collaborative partners rather than just a tool?
Yeah, a big thing I think a lot of people miss when building agentic systems is the need to evaluate, ground your agents, understand what they're producing, right? And if it's aligned with what you want to produce, making sure that what they're producing is the value you're putting into the effort, you know, your ROI, return on investment. That's a key aspect of building any of these agentic systems, multi-agent or otherwise, is being able to evaluate and making sure that what you're putting in is the value for what you're getting out. Be it token consumption, the amount of time it takes, and the amount of labor or other terms that you're saving.
Imagine I'm working alongside an AI agent as a colleague, right? Apart from evaluation, which is a huge part of it, what is next? Because let's say I trust the agent, I work alongside it. Is there other things we need to do? Is there another mindset we need to have?
I work in AI all the time, and I don't think 90% of the population would be ready for a digital core. But yeah, if we get to that point, and I'm assuming they probably will get to that point. To me, that's an idea right now. I think it's going to take time and acceptance by people and understanding. And to be honest, we could actually build digital coworkers now, the technologies we have, to do various tasks. Not every task somebody might need to do. But then we get into issues about jobs. Is it taking away jobs? Are we replacing people? That becomes a sour note, right? There's not a lot of legislation in various governments about these things. But I suspect that in the future, you might have to have some human bodies in your organization over digital people. Maybe that's going to be a rule. I've seen similar rules in other countries for diversity and other aspects. Maybe it's going to be the same thing, right? There's legislation to say you must actually have this number of human coworkers per digital coworkers or something.
Yeah, I can see dozens of roles coming out of this because I already see AI evaluation engineer is a real thing. But did you see that Sam Altman claimed that Meta was trying to poach OpenAI's engineer and offer him a ridiculous amount of money? It's like $100 million, which I would take it with a bit of grain of salt, but I can see where there's many millions there. So you can see how important this is getting. And I do see new roles emerging. And to wrap this up, talking again about these feedback loop, responsibility, feedback, and supervision is going to be a huge part of this. And I do know in your book, you did talk a lot about feedback loops. Is there anything else you can tell us about designing these effective feedback mechanisms for agents, especially working semi-autonomously?
In our systems, we have a direct feedback loop, thumbs up, thumbs down, and answer a question. That's become very powerful for us. If an agent's giving an answer, attach a feedback mechanism to that agent so that you can get human feedback directly. I think that's a powerful system that gives us the ability to monitor the agent output, but also direct feedback that we can leverage and improve the agents and the agentic system. That feedback mechanism by humans or even by agents can be pretty powerful. I use agents as not only part of evaluation, but actually have them look at the whole process and generate feedback. How could things improve? How could things get better?
Well, Michael, this has been a great conversation. Can you tell us a little bit about when's the second edition of the book coming out?
The second edition should be out later this year. I'm hoping to get it out as soon as possible because a lot of the content has become dated and can be better presented now. So hopefully later this year. Thank you.
And for people to follow your work in general, what's the best platform to connect with you on?
I have an AI-assisted blog on Medium that I post to every day. LinkedIn is probably a good place if you need to reach out.
I would encourage our listeners to check out your book, AI in Action. I did find it very approachable. Loads of good code examples. I think it was a fantastic introduction to AI agents, as was this conversation. This was definitely an education.
Thank you.
And we'll have to have you at ODSC, maybe in person. We're hosting another one in San Francisco.
I believe I'm teaching a course in July 27th.
AI Summit. That's right. Yeah. That's coming up, our agentic AI. For our listeners, that's 3 weeks of 2 days a week in the afternoon. So you can do it at work, do it at home, check that out. And Michael, we'll see you on that. Super excited. What's the course going to be on? Obviously, it'll be agents.
AI agents.
Excellent. All right, Michael, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Your engagement directly contributes to the growth and success of our community. Please subscribe now and don't miss out on the next enlightening episode. This episode is sponsored by ODSU West, the premier AI Builders Conference celebrating its 10th year this October 28th to 30th in San Francisco and virtually. Learn more at odsc.com/California and use the code PODCAST for an exclusive 10% discount. Supporting our podcast by subscribing not only helps our small dedicated team at ODSC, but also unlocks exclusive benefits for you.